Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show. Episode 430 of the Roguecast, recorded August 29th, 2023. 100 Vulcan Butts in a Corner. Welcome back to the Roguecast. We are talking about the fifth week of comics in August.
Oh, is it a fifth week?
It is a fifth week.
So that's historically the kind of weird weeks. Although this isn't that particularly weird. There's some...
It's a little weird. There's
it doesn't
a
have,
lot
like,
of
big releases
yeah.
in it, necessarily, but there's some interesting stuff in the mix.
Yes. Yep. We'll talk about some games that came in this week. There's a lot of games this week.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about some TV and some movies and stuff.
Yeah, people are watching that Ahsoka thing.
Yep.
We're going to talk about that.
And we might talk about a trailer. Well, a single trailer.
A single trailer, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, a single trailer.
But it's a single trailer for a movie by David Fincher.
It's true.
It's true.
Is it a Netflix movie? Or
it is a Netflix movie.
Okay,
yeah.
Then we'll get to that.
Yeah. So, game-wise, I guess notable thing first is that we got, like, over 200 minis back in stock.
Oh, man.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Nick and I are still...
David and I tried to block that out.
having flashbacks to it. But yes, it was one of, if not the largest miniatures order we've ever had. Maybe the initial arrival might have been bigger, but I'm not sure.
It was
I don't
a
think
big
it was.
Restock.
This was more.
I think you're right. And so
we got like Tabaxis are back.
Tabaxis,
Backstreet back again.
What is it? Dragonborn. What are the what
every
are the
stripe
other races?
Of human,
every stripe of rogue,
half elf.
Right.
Yes.
But there were
elf,
some of the other
dwarf.
Oddball ones. The only thing I didn't see Talistar. Was Aarakocra.
I believe those were still out, yeah.
Kenku
were back, yeah. Like, some of the oddballs.
Kalistar.
Beholders, owlbears, the sort of most popular of the monsters. And we got a lot of them.
Yep.
But, you know, they will still potentially go fast.
Three different types of mind flayers.
Yeah. As always, and so we had to do quite a bit of rearranging. It was just to make it all work. But everything is still where it was. We just, that just meant behind the scenes there was a lot of shimmying around of things.
It was a day's worth of Tetris.
It was a whole day's worth of Tetrising to make it work.
But as a result, for the customers, we have many minis of varying kinds.
It's true.
Yeah, this is as good a time to get your player character mini or monster minis as we've had all year or like in the last couple years.
Yep.
You know, somebody came in the other day while we were doing it, Nick, and he was just looking for, as he put it, something cool to paint. He somehow didn't find it. I don't know how. Like, these are literally the coolest mini company that we've ever carried.
Yep.
And there's tons and tons of cool stuff. I don't know.
We also got, like, four different types of Warforged.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I knew there was, like, another one of the sort of main races that people were looking for that we had gotten. So, yeah, Warforged is back in the mix.
Monk, Barbarian... Can't remember the other two.
Yeah, we've got a big, big selection of minis again. We've always had a pretty decent selection, but we definitely got a big restock. So, we got the game Cosmoctopus, which is has been a highly anticipated game. It is from the creator of Parks.
We've already sold several of them.
It is a game in which you are trying to be the first cultist to summon the great inky octopus from beyond.
Yeah, I remember when you were... You told us
I
about
this,
or you played at the Gamma, yeah. And... I've seen people buzzing about it lately and picking that up. And, fun to say, Cosmoctopus.
Indeed. And it also comes with little plastic tentacles.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah. It's a lot of fun. It's a really good game. We also got Tales from Red Dragon Inn, which is a big, giant game. Red Dragon Inn, for those who don't know, is a game of, like, fantasy adventurers. After the adventure, they go to the tavern, and they drink, and they figure out how to split up the treasure. And that's your game is basically to try to get everybody drunk so you can take the biggest share of treasure.
Right.
Tales from the Red Dragon Inn is actually a kind of like Descent style app driven.
It's like playing the adventure that they would have before they go to the tavern.
Yep.
That seems pretty cool.
So if you're looking for a slightly tongue in cheek D&D type adventure,
right? Yep. I know that there's like over the years that a lot of the expansions they put out for Red Dragon Inn had colorful new characters and things like that. And I don't know if, those names recur in this or if they've got their own characters for it, but imagine it'd be fun to take some of those kind of those characters and, drop them in a dungeon.
Yeah. We got the Star Trek RPG for Lower Decks, which is...
it's like the source book.
It's a source book, and it's a source book for how to play sort of less officers, a little bit more on the downside.
Right, right. The enlisted dudes.
You can play Tendi.
You can play Tendi.
Yep.
There's a lot of info in these books. These are pretty detailed source books.
Yep. I only wish they didn't shrink wrap them, because I want to flip through them. Whenever I've flipped through the Star Trek ones, they have great art in them. And I assume that this must use lots of art from the animated show and stuff, which is about to start back up again.
Yep.
So their timing is good, probably intentional.
Are they shrink wrapped because they have maps?
No, it's because of nudity.
Yeah,
lots of nudity. Vulcan nudity.
Star Trek nudity.
I believe
I only like Borg nudity.
It's just gothic stuff.
Instead of page numbers, they just have a number of Vulcan butts. So if you get like the 100th page, there's like 100 Vulcan butts in the corner.
So to answer your question,
a naked Spock.
I don't believe there's a map or anything in there, or other than just the maps that are on the pages and stuff. So I don't think there's a real reason for them to be shrink wrapped, other than some sort of preservation of stuff. One of us should crack one of those open and see if that's true, or if like three maps fall out.
Why does Modiphius hurt us? Why can they not show us
that? I'm just saying they make this good production stuff, and they do look visually good.
And then they hide it.
Let the people see them. Show them what you got, Modiphius. Let's see the goodies.
Show your Vulcan butts.
Show your Vulcan butts.
Shake your moneymakers, Modiphius.
We got an expansion for Smash Up.
Before you get to that, did we also not get the solo adventure things, or at least some of them?
We did, but they're all gone.
No!
They sold out and then they're all gone.
Yeah.
Is it going to be gone for a little bit?
Maybe.
Well, just so people know, there exists a little, I think we talked about this briefly maybe before, but a sort of solo role-play thing that does it also have, the rules to the game in it?
Yeah, it's a full game.
Yeah, but, kind of choose your own adventure, but with dice rolls and kind of a deeper dive. And hopefully we'll get it back in again before too long.
Dave is toying with you.
I know.
It's good to know about.
I was going to leave it out. I was going to leave it out to toy with people, but Dave wants to torment people.
No, people would think we didn't even think about it. We didn't even consider it. They're like, Rogues doesn't even care.
Dave is offering up forbidden knowledge like the Cosmoctopus. Anyway, we also got a Smash Up expansion. This is the card game where you take different factions and mix them up and try to take bases. There's a lot of sort of like pop culture riffing that goes on in this. This new one is called Excellent Movies Dudes, and it is based, the factions are clearly the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the Ghostbusters, RoboCop, and Back to the Future.
Nice. Yep.
None of these are official, but you can tell that's what they are.
Yes. Right. He'd be like Robotic Lawman.
He is Robotic Lawman. and return to the time that is not the present.
And the anti-ghosts.
Yes. The ghost wranglers.
The ghost wranglers.
At least popular course, brand of pants ever,
And of course, the prepubescent.
Oh, no. I don't like using that word. What was the one that they would have adolescent black belt hamsters.
Yeah,
I forgot about that.
That was a thing. Somebody notable did that back in the day. That was their first comic.
I remember who it was, but somebody notable,
I'm going to, while you continue on, Randy, I'm going to look it up.
All right, so let's talk about comics for August 30th. As we noted, this is kind of a kind of weird stuff. There's not a lot of new, brand new series or anything. Actually, there are, but they're sort of weird ones, like specials and...
Yeah.
So one of them is the kicking off of a small crossover between Batman and Catwoman called The Gotham War.
Yep.
And this week we have Battle Lines, which is the first issue.
Right. There's a little mini series, a little crossover. It's going to be this start, two issues of each of their books.
Yep. And then a special.
And I think a trio of one-shots.
Okay. So this is a Batman and Catwoman are going to come to blows.
Yeah, the interesting thing about it is
they hate each other.
I don't want to spoil the actual premise for it. It's probably going to get out there pretty quickly, but it's a little kind of Marvel Civil War, wherein there's two kind of decisive ways that different ways they have about dealing with crime in Gotham. Batman's is traditional, beat it up.
Yes, break bones.
Catwoman has a notion to. I can only sort of say, I guess I'll slightly reveal, it's kind of allows for stealing from the rich, in a way, but minimizes violent crime, and she's got a plan that's kind of already been in motion while he was recovering, because he was almost comatose for a month plus from being possessed by Deadman in, Night Terrors?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. And so the Bat family, like, Catwoman is like, hey, I'm doing this. And she, like, calls a meeting of the Bat family to say, to, like, voice their opinions on it. I think knowing full well and everybody's going to be on board. And you can see how that plays out. I thought it was pretty interesting.
It was.
It's between Batman's regular writer, it was written by Batman regular writer Chip Zdarsky mm-hmm. and Catwoman regular writer Tini Howard,
yep.
I think. Mm-hmm. And like, to some degree, I'm like, this is just an interesting question for them to be examining. It sort of speaks to somewhat to real world discussions of these kind of issues, of crime and what's at the heart of it. And so I think it'll generate some interesting discussion. So I don't know if it'll be good, but I don't know. I like the first issue.
With its comparisons, are you saying that Batman is Iron Man and Catwoman is Captain America?
Yes. If this were Civil War, Batman would be Law and Order, and Catwoman would be not Civil Liberties, which is kind of who Cap was in that, but she would definitely be
in favor of crime.
She's in favor of crime. But she's in favor of overthrowing the 1%.
Yes,
which was at least a glimpse of what we had in like Nolan's Batman. That was her Catwoman in that.
I'm rooting for Catwoman. Then
I am also rooting for Catwoman.
We all are. Batman's the villain.
Yep. You know, he was in the Ra's al Ghul one shot that Tom Taylor did. That was really good too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Like Batman. Minor spoiler, but. Unrelated. I watched just a little bit of the Flash movie over the weekend. It's on Max now.
I watched the whole thing.
Yep, I'm sorry. there's a funny bit early on where Wonder Woman has a little cameo sequence, and they do the gag we've sometimes seen in other media and stuff, where Batman is holding the lasso after taking care of like some bad guys or whatever that were tied up with it. And he just kind of starts talking, and he says something like, he's like, I do what I do to hide away the pain I still feel from, you know, childhood or whatever. Yep. And he's like, I could probably do a lot more, if I wasn't just attacking people, but gave away all my money or whatever and used it to end poverty.
Yep.
You know? Like, yep. It's funny. It was kind of funny because this is some, you know, common kind of lightweight discussion on message boards. But I just dropped in there. I would say that was my favorite moment in the whole 20-30 minutes I saw. The rest I will consign to oblivion as I become a regular drug user.
Did you even get to Michael Keaton?
Nope. Yeah. My plan is, because I was like, oof, I'm not really feeling this movie's writing, is to maybe, like, this will be a thing that's on in the background while I'm cooking or cleaning.
Yeah.
At some point, and then I will look up every once in a while to see him say, "You want to get nuts?"
It's true,
and probably, you know, in a few years when you reconsider, you're like, "Oh, this is really good." I'm gonna sit down and rewatch it.
Yeah, compared to the weird new direction that James Gunn chose, where they're all squirrels.
chitter.
There is another. There's an Action Comics Doomsday special, which I guess Doomsday is Lord of Hell now.
Sure.
Yes, something I think from the events of Lazarus Planet. That was one of the fallouts. I'm not quite sure how a mist of that weird made weird powers things happen spreading across the earth made him go to hell, but it did.
Did he smoosh Neron?
Not that I saw, but Neron's not getting in his way, I guess.
Maybe he just like put a resume in.
You know,
it's
so
like, dearest sirs, please consider me for Lord of Hell.
Are you saying the Doomsday Shakespeare?
Yes.
I read just the first few pages of this, and aside from, I will say unequivocally, the art in it is amazing.
Yeah, Eddie Barrows, right?
Eddie Barrows' art is super good. It's very, very kind of detailed artwork. But there's kind of a neat thing that happens is Supergirl is talking to Clark, and she's like, I had a weird dream about Doomsday last night. And she's like, I'm sorry to bring it up. And they kind of talk a little bit about it. And then, like, I thought there was actually good writing where Superman was saying, like, he's like, I felt, like, so lost and bone-tired. I was like, I think this is what, you know, like, people without our powers, humans, this is, like, what they, the way they feel when they're at their very most broken is how I felt when I was fighting him. And they do a good job of making him sound scary. And then you find out that the reason she had a dream and that there was some stuff layered into it is because Manhunter had some encounter with him and had, like, received, like, a psychic sort of like pulse or something from him, and like had to redirect it, and also wanted to. It had Kryptonian stuff in it, I guess. and so had, like, kind of implanted in her mind and then had set out to find her and, like, arrives the next day or whatever. And then they're going to, like, telepathically communicate about it and try and perceive what's going on, and they're able to, I think, track him down to hell. But then a weird thing happens because of, I guess, hell mysticism stuff, which is, like, you're looking into hell and you are drawn into hell.
That's what Nietzsche always said.
Yes, that's, I think, what he said. The Doomsday is mentioned in that quote, famous quote.
Do you think Friedrich Nietzsche should get co-credit for creating Doomsday?
Probably. If you look too deeply into Doomsday's Abyss... Doomsday's Abyss also looks into you.
I don't like Doomsday's Abyss's phrase. I just don't.
Anyway, and then the majority of the issue takes place, like, in hell. There are other demons in it. There's some weird, you know, some cool Dante's Inferno-type stuff.
And also a semi-obscure 90s character, right?
We don't reveal
it, but if you read the Doomsday story, you'll recognize this character.
It's true.
Yeah, and well-drawn, if nothing else. Yeah. I haven't read the back half, but I have to say it surprised me because I have no particular fandom or nostalgia for the Death of Superman era. Yeah. But I was like, that's pretty decently written.
Yeah. And then Furry Green Lantern Gnort has his swimsuit special.
He does.
Didn't you just say Nort?
I don't know.
All right.
I thought it was...
You probably say Nort, but people know who Nort is. They don't know who Gnort is either.
Well, for those who don't know, the guy who's the ringleader of the swimsuit special is a sort of a dog. You know how was it Barf in Spaceballs?
Yep.
He kind of looks like if Barf was a Green Lantern, and really almost about the same level of intelligence. He was a doofus Green Lantern from the era of Justice League International when it was all kind of a little bit goofy.
Yep.
And you know, so who better to take you through a series of swimsuit pinups and, as the solicit reads, swimtacular stories. I guess they must have been doing some swimsuit covers just for the summer.
Yeah.
And so this compiles those. And then there's some lightweight summer fun stuff. You know, it honestly looked pretty fun.
It has three different pinups, depending on which cover you buy,
yep,
right?
Yep, it's true.
That's correct.
One of them has...
one's a little scary.
Yeah.
One of them has Poison Ivy.
Yep.
And what is the other? Is it
one
like...
One has Babs and
Nightwing. No, Babs and Nightwing, yep.
Yep.
And the other one is Furry Norton is Full Glory.
Yep. You know, somebody out there is going to enjoy that one.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, more power to them, I say, wear the Nort fursuit.
We have a new company called Distillery. It's sort of called Distillery, except take all the vowels out. So it's D-S-T-L-R-Y.
What's the t-shirts you wear, Randy, that do the same thing?
Roosevelt's.
Yeah, don't they do the same thing?
Yes, but they're cool and this is lame.
No, it's all the same thing.
It is the same thing, I think.
Distillery is...
this is called The Devil's Cut.
And it's kind of like a preview of like the massive creator lineup they have, right?
So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 stories.
And it's like in an oversized sort of...
The black label format?
Yeah, the black label format.
It really feels like everyone is chasing heavy metal, like on this
but
kind
this,
of stuff.
This has a really good, like, James Tinian and Christian Ward do the opening story. Yeah. Joelle Jones is in the art. Mirka Andolfo, Jock, Azzarello and Rizzo are back together. Snyder and Francavilla, Jamie McKelvey, Rom V and Lee Garbutt.
It is a crazy loadout.
Yeah.
Now, Randy, are we going to... After this, are they going to get normal comics? Are they going to do graphic novels? What do you know? What the format for the rest of their stuff will be?
I don't know, actually.
Okay, but this is the lead into it, and it's not. We should say they are all standalone short stories. I think it's not like you're going to be like it's the first issue of all their different superheroes,
right?
These and you know Scott Snyder's not a guy who would be doing that anyway. Brian Azzarello is not a guy who would be doing that anyway.
No, it's more. It's definitely more horror sci-fi flavored.
Okay,
yeah. But, yeah, you know, it's worth seeing when a new
company
launches.
Yeah, like, I feel like the names alone will kind of might indicate whether this is going to be up your alley.
Marvel has a new book, the Miss Marvel, The New Mutant. I don't know if you guys heard, Miss Marvel was dead for about a week.
Yep.
Now she's back.
And they've kind of wildly undone it. But, yeah, she is kind of like, she's hanging with the mutants now. And things are crazy for mutants because of the events in the Hellfire Gala and what has become the Fall of X. Is that what they call it?
Yeah. So Kamala is basically infiltrating a program at ESU run by the evil anti-mutant organization Orcus.
Okay. I saw that in their little opening, they did the Welcome to the X-Men Kamala Khan. Hope you survived the experience. Yep.
It is co-written by Iman Vellani, who played Ms. Marvel in the show and in the movie coming up. And also co-written by the creators who wrote a lot of the episodes of the Ms. Marvel TV show.
Okay, right on.
There is a Marvel Age 1000. This is one of those occasional, it's an anniversary, I don't know.
You might be wondering,
what anniversary it is?
Should I have read Marvel Age 1 through 999 beforehand?
Yeah, this won't make any sense if you're an anniversary.
In fact, yes, it's just like, it's just a name.
This is actually my favorite thing from this week.
So this is just an anthology of sort of short stories with a variety of artists and writers. And all the stories are set in sort of the Marvel Silver Age, right?
It's, yeah, like they're what we think of as the, ironically, the Golden Age of Marvel. Stan and Jack working together in the 60s. We're talking about early X-Men. Well, you know what? Some
it's
of those,
not completely, because
like, you're right, because there's a Spider-Man that's in the present.
And there's also a
Captain Marvel,
Jane Foster,
a.k.a. the Captain Marvel. And his is, that would have been like the 70s. But
it's kind of in a, just...
It's funny, the solicit for it made it sound like it was more in the past. But yeah, I can say it's, it does jump around a bit. But a number of the stories are there. And there's also one that's, I guess I'd say it's Marvel's full span of history. Because there's also one that's about the original Human Torch. And that's set in like the 1940s.
Correct.
But anyway, yeah, like you, Nick, I found several stories to like in here. I didn't read every single one. But like, I like the Human Torch one. There's an interesting one with, Scott Summers and Jean Grey kind of in the early days of their kind of flirting in the, you know...
That was my favorite. I thought that was really good. That art by Marguerite Sauvage.
Sauvage.
And it was written by Rainbow Rowell, who does that romance stuff really well.
Yeah. And Nick, you pointed out one that I liked quite a bit, too. What was the one?
The Dan Slott and Mike Allred, Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
It was.
I didn't realize, like, in his early days, I guess he was kind of an infiltrator guy.
Yeah.
And a little bit like how Silver Surfer was, you know, just the Herald of Galactus, but then he was moved by humanity and kind of changed his ways. That apparently something like that happened to Marvel. And they kind of have a neat idea to sort of chronicle that.
I didn't catch that this was written by Armando Iannucci.
Who's that?
With Adam Q. He is the guy who's the big TV, British TV guy who did, like, Veep.
Yep.
And In the Cut and that kind of thing.
Which one did he write?
He wrote this Daredevil story.
Oh, okay.
Which was good. It talks about him getting tinnitus, which I thought was a neat little...
That would be rough.
Jesus. yeah, like, Doctor Strange, can you cure me of that? Although there's also... Steve McNiven also did a Silver Surfer one, where McNiven is kind of doing a style that's clearly meant to evoke Mobius's Silver Surfer.
It's sort of a conversation between him and
Mephisto.
Mephisto, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, well, Mephisto was like his big bad in the solo series.
And also, I mean, just the creative teams that they got on there. Cause, like,
I think this is worth a look, even though we are not normally, or at least I am not normally a fan of anthology format stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think this one might be worth your look, Marvelites.
Yep. Sean Murphy of Batman White Knight, and among other things, has a new series called The Plot Holes that he's writing and drawing for the company Massive Entertainment,
okay.
Massive Publishing. It's sort of a meta thing. They bring in this sort of would-be comics writer who exists in a universe. They're basically all writers and creators from different universes, and they're going around editing stories so they don't disappear.
Okay.
And by editing stories, they're actually going into the story and changing the events.
There's some really odd calls.
It's a Morrisonian
things.
Concept. It is a very, like,
Dave, your
meta concept.
Your Dragonlance boy Tanis gets name checks.
He does.
Probably.
The woman shows up and hands the guy a sword, and she's like, tell me about the sword. And he's like, well, it kind of looks like Tanis from Dragonlance. They're doing a lot of like meta.
Well, I don't know if that's a good idea.
Yeah.
but yeah, that's interesting, though. That's kind of cool and different and stuff.
Yeah. And it's got really, really nice artwork, as always, from Sean Murphy. Black Hammer comes to the end. I kept thinking it was ending, but this is the final ending.
The final ending.
Of Jeff Lemire's sort of superhero pastiche. It is a crazy future, something going out destroying worlds.
Is it his Legion future?
It's something else.
Okay.
Is this the last issue? Or
no,
this is
the last miniseries.
So this is the beginning of the end.
The beginning of the end.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Don't call it the end until we get to the end of the end.
Okay, fair enough.
As Howard Cosell famously said.
The Constant of Chaos annuals continue. This one is Moon Knight versus one of the Korean heroes in Tiger Force. Most notable because it is written by Jed McKay.
Right, a lot of these annuals have not been written by the regular creative team, but this is the regular Moon Knight guy doing his thing.
And then new issues of World Tree and Ultimate Invasion, and also a trade collection of The Avengers, The Kang Dynasty. This is Kurt Busiek's story. This is the best Kang story.
Yeah, it's very good.
It's a big epic one. I don't know how long it actually was in turn. I remember it taking a little while to come out. Avengers 41-55, so 14 issues. So basically over a year's worth of issues. That's a pretty long story.
Yeah, that's pretty epic. And if you are a fan of the Kang, this is I would say probably his finest hour.
Yeah.
Didn't we also get trade paperbacks for the first Scarlet Witch and the second Jason Aaron Punisher?
Yes, we did.
Is that the very first Scarlet Witch from?
It is.
Yes.
Okay, it is.
And there's a ton of graphic novels and books this week from YA stuff to indie stuff.
Yeah. Random one that was kind of caught my attention yesterday when we were prepping these and counting and stuff. There's a little kids board book that's basically like Cars, Pixar's Cars, but with Batman's Cars.
Yes.
And it's very cute and fun, and it's like well drawn too. So that, like, you know, they've got names for all the different vehicles for, like, the Batwing and stuff like
What's
that.
What's the Batmobile's name?
There is it does have a name, but I'm going to blank on it. All I remember is that the name of, there's, like, a big Bat truck, and his name is Buff. they were very delightful.
Gotta have to look at this, because if it's the Bat truck I'm thinking of, that would have been from Snyder's run.
I mean, that might have been where they pulled it. Randy, there was two other things I was going to mention, just that came out, single issues that came out this week. The second issue of Garth Ennis's, I don't know, like, police procedural slash horror thing, Ribbon Queen, so anybody was following that. And then they did another, they've been continuing to do these DC cover collections, if you didn't mention that.
Oh, yeah, I didn't.
Catwoman Uncovered. This is basically, you know, a bunch of Catwoman covers from the last few, last year or two. What else have they done? Poison Ivy, Harley, Joker, maybe?
Yeah.
I mean, all of those.
A lot of Bat Family.
Some of, like, the best covers. I mean, this one has, Jenny Frizzin and.
Good cover from Frank Cho right out of the gates in there. Let's see, I mean, Art Germ does a bunch of, does at least several of these covers. Old school Jim Baylin right there from the 90s. Stephen Sedgwick. Right. There's another one from Art Germ. If you like the Catwoman as well, you should check this one out. This is a cute one of her and Harley right there.
That is good.
It's delightful. Anyway, that's it.
All right. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about some TV and movies and stuff. All right, you may have noticed our news has been a little light late, but we've definitely noticed. I think the strikes are having that effect.
Yep.
And again, as always, go strike.
Yep.
Get what you deserve, because the AMPTP are greedy bastards.
It's true.
Yes.
It's going to get worse, though, because now they were starting to move some pretty big movies.
They moved Dune.
They moved Dune.
We didn't even talk about that. They moved
March
Dune
of 2024.
To this year. Yeah.
Dune is big, but Dune isn't like Star Wars big, right?
Yeah. Well, it's big for Warner Brothers.
It was big, and it was going to be a big. I mean, Warner Brothers can afford to move it because they have Barbie,
right?
And
that just
made
$1 billion.
Blue Beetle didn't do like huge, it did pretty well. So like they can afford to move. Like, I hate that David Zaslav is being rewarded for this behavior. But anyway, that's why Dune can afford to move, but it's going to hurt theater owners,
right?
Like, it's definitely gonna hurt them, but they don't want to try and launch a movie when they can't have any stars promoting it. We'll see if they move the Marvels. They haven't made any noises about it, but
it's true because out of all of them, Disney needs a hit. They really do.
Theater owners probably feel a little sketchy since the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah.
Denis Villeneuve had his movie premiere during a pandemic, and then now it gets moved because of a writer's strike.
Right.
You know.
Well, that. The theaters did this thing on Sunday that was kind of like our free comic book day thing. They did the $4 day. Did you guys know about
this? Yeah, I saw a couple of my friends like, mess with it.
All the movies. Like, I saw a friend who went to try to see the Barbie movie for the first time. I was like, well, that's a little late, but okay. He couldn't get in because all the tickets were sold out because it was $4 ticket day.
Yeah, I've heard that. You know, it's interesting. I was kind of just remembering that during the pandemic that Christopher Nolan was like, I will save movies with Tenet.
That didn't work out.
And that didn't work out. But then he did...
He did Oppenheimer.
Oppenheimer. And that thing is like packing houses still.
Sure. Sure. Well, I mean, it's half a Barbie, but it's nice. It's nice.
But for like, I think he's probably okay with that. Well, half a Barbie is still a lot.
I will say for an R-rated movie, the money it's made
R-rated is... R-rated three-hour biopic?
Yeah, it's doing tremendous numbers.
It's cute. It's no Barbie. It's cute.
I want to watch it, but I guess I'll have to go to theaters for this one.
Is it not...
I think because it's about to have another wave at IMAX theaters he is pushing...
There's always a secondary explosion.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Anyway, none of that has to do with what we're talking about, which is a trailer for Netflix's new movie, The Killer, which has been in development for a while.
Yep.
This is David Fincher's new movie. It is based on a graphic novel, a series of European graphic novels that we all liked way back in the day, like... 20 years ago?
Wasn't it by Matz?
It's by Matz.
And Mortat.
Yes. No, not Mortat.
Not Mortat?
Giacomon or something like that.
Oh, right. It was Giacomon and Matz.
Yeah. It's These are not names we're making up, by the way. These are the names. But it's about a killer who's sort of this sociopathic killer who's a hitman who... We get a very, very much a window into his thoughts, and he is explaining how he morally justifies his job.
Right. And you see a lot of the very moment-to-moment stuff, including boredom and things like that, when he's just, like, kind of got to stake somebody out. Yeah. And lots of little... what I can only think of as tips and tricks.
Tips and tricks on how to be a hitman.
On the hitman life. At least the way it was handled as a graphic novels, is kind of each graphic novel would be a different hit or adventure.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, would put him in some kind of difficult circumstances. There were certain action-adventure-y elements in it sometimes. You know, he might run up against another hitman at times.
Sure, I think there was a chase or one another where, like, he had to get away from the cops or something.
But it wasn't like... We're not talking John Wick stuff here. No. This is rooted in reality, if a little bit heightened.
What's interesting, actually, is Fassbender's kind of a weird call because the guy was kind of a schlubby European dude. He was not...
Yeah, as I recall.
I was just looking at some artwork. It's close.
Is it?
Okay. Didn't he have, like, kind of curly hair, Nick?
He has, like, short,
I thought he was, like, curly hair and was balding or something like that.
I thought he was balding, yeah. Anyway,
Fassbender's wearing a hat. You don't.
We all Fassbender wears a hat. We all liked the graphic novel and the trailer. I think I was not as blown. I thought the trailer was a little jump cutty.
So the trailer is kind of a stylish trailer.
Yeah,
it's kind of more of a teaser trailer. It has like this overlapping litany that's like sounds like the internal monologue of the killer, which would fit the comic.
Yep.
But it, you know, has him emphasizing over and over, stick to the plan. He's like, you know, empathy is a weakness, and sort of what is clearly his mantras, sort of building it up. I don't know, and you know, you see him both like planning and preparing and being very precise in timing and setups, but also some things going wrong and like some sort of slightly shootouty looking things with people.
I also think it's going to be like a psychological thriller in the sense that it's going to be him losing his mind a little bit.
You think?
I think...
Well, he definitely is, like, a damaged person. He is, like, a sociopath. And I think it'll be some sort of window into that.
Because I think it's also, like, lots of downtime and, like, waiting for hits to happen. And, like, how does the brain kind of hold itself during that time? Fincher rarely makes a boring movie.
That's true.
It's true.
Even something like The Social Network is pretty watchable.
Oh, that's insanely watchable. It's...
Well, I don't know about that.
I have watched it many of times. It's one of my favorite movies of that year.
Yeah?
It's
what year
very
was that? 2012.
What?
Social Network?
When did The Social Network come out?
Oh, man. I don't remember. I'm kind of with Dave on this one. I watched Social Network once, liked it okay. It's got that Sorkin dialogue, but I was like, oh, I don't care about the subject matter.
I've watched it multiple times.
I think
times.
It was that, and also, like, the lead, who is not Michael Cera, but fake Michael Cera.
It was Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah, Jesse Eisenberg.
Andrew Garfield.
I kind of don't like either of them.
Eisenberg was in Zombieland.
Yeah, I had to work. I had to work past it. I had to work past it. All right. And I do like Zombieland, though. Everybody gets one, Randy.
Yes.
anyway, it's hard to tell a lot from this Fincher trailer. I'll be curious how they, you know, I think they'll probably focus on like a few hits essentially in it. But like, yeah, I don't know where he will go. He's had success with sociopathic killers before, from Seven to Zodiac,
yep,
and elements in a lot of his other movies. We were talking about this before. Yep. I feel like, you know, Gone Girl has like meticulously planned and staged fake murders and things like that. And like, there's, he's at Fight Club and stuff like that. He likes damaged personalities. He likes procedural elements. Mindhunter on Netflix, of course, too.
I had to check who did the music and the killer. It's, of course, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Okay, yeah.
They started working together and doing really pretty great
stuff. That's great. Since The Social Network was, I think, their
was
first one.
Social Network, I thought, was Girl with Dragon Tattoo after that?
Oh.
Because Dragon Tattoo was the first time I remember
Reznor. What are you talking about?
Reznor and his co... Oh.
Reznor did Seven.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Like, Nine Inch Nails did Seven, I think.
Okay. Reznor as a composer, though, kind of, this was the Oingo Boingo to composer switch.
Right, I think so, yeah, like, moving from Oingo Boingo to Danny Elfman.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, from Oingo Boingo to Trent Reznor. You know, Trent Reznor is Oingo Boingo.
He changed his name to Trent Boingo.
Now I want to hear a mashup of, I want to fuck you with, like, an animal with Oingo Boingo's style.
The famous Oingo Reznor.
Oingo Reznor.
So the thing that this movie could remind me of in a good way, but I'd have to see more of it to know. Nick, have you ever seen the original Day of the Jackal from like the 70s?
It's very good.
So for people who haven't seen it, no real relation to the cheeseball sort of Bruce Willis movie.
No.
It is a... almost
that's a schlocky summer blockbuster, right. Where Day of the Jackal is a very confined, like,
it's almost like a what do you call it? Like a documentary,
yeah,
where like it spends about half its time with the cop who's trying to look into investigate the possible an assassination attempt on what the French president, mm-hmm, something like that, and about half is watching the trail of the killer takes on the way there. You know, how he procures his weapons, disguise, you know, figures out where the president's going to be and all that stuff. And it's a very suspenseful movie, but it's also, like, very paced in that sort of 70s style where it will just kind of let you watch him for, you know, many minutes at a time, or the police kind of side of things. And it is not flashy. And I'm sort of hoping that that is actually the... something of what that movie is like, because that has actually one of the scariest killers I've seen in it. Nick, do you know the scene in it where he calibrates the target to his gun?
Yeah.
He's taking these shots at like a melon that he's hung from,
yep,
a tree,
mm-hmm,
and it just like spends like 2 minutes showing him, you know, go back. He does a neat little trick where he ties a rope around a tree, like a little tiny rope. Puts the gun up through it, spins the gun like once through it, and it tightens it to the tree.
Yep.
And you just very instantly, you're like, oh, that's pretty cool. It just instantly holds it in place perfectly. And then he takes a shot, recalibrates the sight, takes a shot, recalibrates the sight, takes a shot, blows the melon to pieces.
Yeah.
But it is like, it's a very intense sequence, and I kind of hope this has influence of that. We'll see. It's probably going to be a little bit more pop.
I was going to say, it's probably going to be more pop. I don't know if it
kind of like the trailer. Like, it may be kind of, you know, like, Fincher comes with a certain energy sometimes when he's, the way he edits things, you know, like, even something like Gone Girl did have a kind of a propulsive energy.
Yeah. Do y'all have a favorite Fincher movie?
The Game.
The Fight Club.
Nick?
Zodiac.
Oh, man, Zodiac's way up there for me.
Zodiac is...
I've only seen Zodiac once.
It's a rewarding rewatch.
It is.
Okay.
I also just like there's so many good scenes in it.
There's so many good scenes.
And the fact that it's long, and it is a long movie.
It is a long movie.
But it kind of works to its advantage when all the scenes are good.
I will say that I don't think there's a wrong answer with Fincher. All of his movies are kind of rewatchable.
Panic Room would be a wrong answer.
I even
Panic Room is a wrong answer.
No,
sorry.
No. I even like Panic Room.
Oh, man, I hate Panic.
The, not favorite, though, not.
No, no, not favorite.
You can never say it, but no one will pick that.
But there's a lot of good elements in Panic Room from, like, visually how he shoots scenes and things like that.
No.
I tried to
You get to watch Jared Leto get killed. That's also a good thing.
I tried to watch it as a sympathetic viewing. I was ready to, like, I was like, I know this movie kind of gets trashed. I'm gonna see what I can find in it.
It's also got a really weird shooting backstory. Like, who's the lead in it?
The script?
No, who's the lead in it? It's Jodie Foster. I think she was pregnant like right before shooting, so they had to like they shot part of it, and then they put it on pause for like 6 months or something.
You can tell. I hate that movie.
It also has Forrest Whitaker in it, and who played the daughter? It's somebody who kind of became
Kristen Stewart.
Kristen Stewart. Yeah, yeah. So,
and Dwight Yoakam.
Other than possibly Jared Leto, a uniformly good cast. But yeah, I kind of actively disliked it.
I'm not going to say hate.
So when I was going to watch that movie, I was a big Fincher fan. I liked everything. I'd liked Seven. I liked Fight Club. I liked the Game. I liked everything I watched from him. And I'm like, I was primed to like it. The only thing I wasn't primed to like was I'm like, this is a weird concept for a movie. I don't know where the dramatic tension's going to be. And in fact, that's what my offense to the movie. I was like, okay, you're in the room. Okay, now you're stuck in the room. Okay, and now they're trying to get you out of the room. I hated that movie.
I'm the weird guy who retroactively hates Seven.
You know what? I've soured on Seven a little bit as well because it is so torture porny.
It's so torture porny, and I went back to it last year, and it's not good.
I agree, although I did find it watchable in its way.
Yeah.
Slightly over the top, everything is rainy, every light bulb is flickering. It's like, it's almost like a slightly comical take on, like, X-Files type imagery.
I know.
Aesthetics. It's like morose.
I like his more... The Game is kind of that blend of darkness, but with like a splash of color and light and kind of insanity.
Right.
And well, that is like, kind of what I like more
it's,
from
it's
Fincher.
It's very kind of Hitchcockian in the sense of like suspenseful on its own, but with some very good twists and turns. If people haven't seen The Game, they should see it.
They should.
You know what's funny? I think I've only seen The Game once.
I
did really like it. But anyway, I don't know. The Killer... I like Fassbender. I like the graphic novels. Something about this is not quite grabbing.
What's Fassbender best known for?
I mean, I remember him from playing Magneto.
Right.
What's he known for?
He is a F1 racer.
Okay, what's he known for in acting?
I also... didn't he play the dude in Prometheus?
He did. He was Adam.
Which...
oof.
Wasn't it David?
Or David.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Wow.
He was also in the beloved movie Assassin's Creed.
So he's playing Assassin's.
Oh my.
he played Steve Jobs in Steve Jobs.
Okay.
Magneto's Square One.
You will also know him in Inglorious Bastards. He has a great scene.
That's right. He's in Inglorious Bastards. He's the
the British agent.
I'm going to go out speaking the kings.
It's like, well, if this is how it's going to go down, old boy.
That he is good in that.
Good scene.
Yep.
And honestly, he was a great Magneto. It's a good version. He was good sexy Magneto.
Yep.
He's
good intense scenes where all of a sudden he murders everyone in the room.
Yes.
Which that might work for the killer.
Yeah, we'll see.
He's kind of an odd guy who's done a lot of crap.
I will be curious to see trailer 2 for this one. Yeah. I think I'll get more of a sense of it. Agreed. I'm almost certain to give it a shot.
If we get one, I don't think we will.
Yeah, so. If we don't, we don't. That's fine. This is a rare Hitman movie that will probably get past my radar because of... Based on product, a comic I liked and by a director I like. So yeah. I'll probably give it a shot.
And then you'll be like, I didn't like it. It was about assassins.
Or I will be like, I really like that. I need to see all the assassin movies I've missed in the last 20 years.
That's when Dave went on a John Wick binge.
Yeah. John Wick Wednesdays.
All right. Let's talk about Ahsoka.
Yeah.
Which, Dave, I'm kind of surprised you didn't watch.
I don't have access to it.
Oh, okay.
Basically, I don't have Disney Plus right now, and I would try and... skate onto Nyx, but they had consolidated some things, and I couldn't.
No, that was me. I consolidated things.
Nick cut me off. He was tired of me living on the dole, and he didn't want me to become a parasite and that Ayn Rand would rise from the grave to kill.
Right.
So...
I assume. I mean, that was my guess.
I thought maybe it was because you're a Star... You're just Star Trek or Star Wars.
I tried to load up Disney Plus and it didn't load, and I was like, this is Nick.
Yeah, you're like, ah, I guess he thinks I'm a leech.
I will say, I have not been ever, at any point really excited for Ahsoka. I didn't... I've watched a fair amount of Clone Wars, but I didn't watch any of Rebels. And so, I like the character. I like Rosario Dawson's portrayal of her on previous stuff. Yep. And I had an interest, but it just hadn't been percolating for me lately. And maybe I was like, maybe that's just kind of a Star Wars thing, because I usually end up getting sucked into whatever Disney Plus Star Wars they do.
You're not Jones it for the way you are this killer movie that...
it's like Rosario Dawson's like, no Fassbender.
You're like, why is there not more assassins in this?
I don't mind. I guess what I should say is I don't mind spoilers. I will still give this a try sometime soon, though.
So, Nick, you and I think we're both anticipating this pretty heavily.
Yes.
I, in fact, bought a shirt.
It's practically a Rebels reunion from what I've heard.
I love Rebels. It is my favorite of the animated Star Wars. I like it better than Bad Batch or Clone Wars, even though I really like both of those. And so... I went back and watched the tail end of Clone Wars, which is sort of the what Ahsoka was up to during Revenge of the Sith.
Yep.
And then I watched the scattered Rebels episodes that she is in, or at least a lot of them.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I did, because I've seen a lot of reviews saying, like, oh, if you haven't watched Rebels, don't bother watching this. I don't think it's quite that bad, but I do think you get more out of it if you know her from Rebels.
Right. They do a good job, if honestly too much of a job, catching you up on certain characters. Because the first two episodes are a little on the slow side.
It's a little slow. I was surprised how slow it was.
I will say, however, the action scenes that they do have are very good. They're well choreographed.
Yep. Yep.
Especially the opening one that has Ahsoka going up against four different HK droids.
Those droids are called droids.
Yeah,
they're kind of an offshoot of like the HK assassin droids.
Oh, not the same thing. One more toy.
One more toy. They look a little old westy. They've got like
They're not the K2SO droids.
No,
oh, okay,
no. These are different. But
how do they look old westy? Are they wearing big cowboy hats or dusters?
They all have sombrero mustaches.
They do have a hat, but they also have kind of like half dusters, kind of like one of them does. They are very cool. They're like red and brown looking.
And you know how the other droids say Roger, Roger? They say howdy, howdy.
Howdy, howdy.
Nick, don't tell him.
No. Wait, what? Remind me, what era is Ahsoka?
It is post-Rebels. It's Mandalorian era.
Yeah, Mandalorian.
Mandalorian era, which is post-Jedi.
Post-Jedi, yep.
But like, how, like 10 years post-Jedi?
I think it's like 5 or 10,
10 years?
Yeah.
Okay.
And
so are these Imperial remnants, or are they Imperial at all?
They're Imperial remnants.
Okay.
So... one of the things this did that I felt was interesting, but is very, very Andor-ish, is that, like, the notion that the Republic... they go to this big shipyard in Corellia.
Yes.
Which was an Imperial place.
Yeah, it was basically an Imperial shipyard.
I thought it was, like, a criminal thing, but apparently it's an Imperial world.
Well, you can't have hired just all Rebels to work at your Imperial shipyard.
So they're like, well, the shipyard was running. These people aren't... The head of the guys like they're not about politics, about money.
Yep.
And so they're basically they have all these Imperial ship workers who are working on the ships, and Ahsoka of course is immediately suspicious, and should be, because they are in fact building Imperial ships.
Yes.
I was like, anytime I like the lesson there of like anytime anyone says it's not political, that means they're on the other side.
Yes.
That's what that means.
It definitely hints that the Rebellion, when they took over, they're not doing a great job.
They're not doing a great job.
Yeah. There are definitely pockets of good. I mean, Hera is a general in the army.
Yep.
She's a badass, I think.
Elizabeth Winstead is great as Hera.
Yeah, she's great. I know...
I feel like I saw, and I don't know if this is just one or two friends of mine, but like a little pushback on her.
Well, Hera was a very determined, very strong character,
mm-hmm.
and she doesn't get a lot to do in these two episodes. So I can see where people might be like... Hera seemed a
little
weaker.
It doesn't quite register as...
But I thought she was good in the role.
I think so, too. And this is a 9-episode season.
Yeah.
So we're going to get a lot more of her, and probably doing a lot more.
Yeah. I feel like, I guess for me, I wanted when they do the action sequences, they're pretty good. The bit of the reveal of the Imperials are in fact all in the room with them at the Corellian thing was my favorite bit, but it's a small bit. There's a lot of slower stuff. Even Chopper and Sabine like flying around together should have been more exciting. Or Hera, it's Hera, right?
Yeah,
should have been more exciting, and it wasn't. I was like,
I liked the Chopper stuff.
I guess I look at the tone
comparable to something, Randy.
It's Andor.
There's no way.
Yeah, it feels more like Andor. It's a little too slow.
It's a little slow and contemplative, where it should be a little more action adventure.
Yeah. So let me ask you, Nick. You remember that episode of Mando last season where they segued to that dude who was in the work reform program or whatever?
Yeah. No, that was more exciting than this.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I assumed it would
be like, if it was slow, it'd be kind of like the way that episode was.
No,
That episode barely had any pew pews, but she does do a womp womp with her lightsaber at some point, right?
Yes.
And so does Sabine. Because that was an element I really enjoyed that they...
Did you just not count those scenes, Randy? Or are they super lame?
They don't count. No, I did like it. I just feel it's a little slow. It was slower than I expected.
I don't 100% agree with your Andor assessment, though, because it's definitely utilizing some of the tone, but it is not Andor.
No, it's not.
I didn't expect really the sophistication of Andor.
No, this is Star Wars by Filoni. This is him channeling the best of Lucas into a sort of a more...
I look at, like, Mandalorian... And Book of Boba Fett, much maligned though it is, and all the live action stuff they've done, and it has a certain tone. It's a little more fun and lighter.
Yeah,
this feels heavier and not as fun.
Is it because Ahsoka has like kind of some angst built into her past?
I think that's part of it.
More than say Mando does. She's, it seems like
come back from the dead, and in some respects,
but she's like left the Jedi Order.
Yeah,
right?
I think Filoni.
She's seen her. Mentor become Darth Vader.
Yeah, I think Filoni's crush on Ahsoka means he's taking this a little too seriously, and I want him to be having more fun with it.
And this is just two episodes, so we might get more fun.
But the tone isn't going to change.
Now that kind
much.
Of interests me. I'm like, oh, I might like lack of fun.
I think you might.
I love the idea that Sabine is her essential Padawan, where she has no connection to the Force whatsoever.
Yeah.
I thought that was a neat idea. I like their villains. I think Ray Stevenson is a formidable
foe.
And I like that he is a villain in quotation marks, because he's still connected to the Force in a way that, like, Jedis are.
I mean, he's a villain. He is murdering a lot of people.
Yeah, he does. But I mean, he doesn't want to kill Ahsoka. He thinks that's one less Jedi in the world, which is an odd stance for a. Yeah. He's not a Sith.
He's not a Sith. Right.
He's something else.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate it. Did you notice that his Padawan actually has the braid?
I didn't catch that. No,
I thought that was really cool.
I think one of my other issues is that I think the casting is all good. Their take on Sabine is a little. Sabine was always pretty fun, too. Like, she had, like, the weight of the Mandalorians and that kind of thing on her. But she was always a lighter character, and they made her very angsty in this.
Well, she lost Ezra, which is a big part of her. She lost her family, all of them kind of scattered to the winds.
Right, sure.
It's not unfeasible that she might be a little sad and kind of lost.
It's not the choice I would have made.
Right.
I understand why they did the way they did, but I was like, this is not the... I wanted the place they get to at the end of episode 2. I wanted them to start from that.
Yeah.
My
one problem with the whole show is it's another map show.
Yeah.
I wish Star Wars would drop that.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Trying to find a map to go to a place, and I'm like, the Star Chart is cool.
I'm like, man,
this is like your third major thing that has included this trope, and
at least they're not on Tatooine.
That's true.
Let me ask you something. I assume we'll go back to how like Rebels wrapped. I know there's some theories about Ezra and stuff like that, but like as far as the audience knew, what was Ezra's fate in Rebels?
So, Ezra used some space squids to take
space
him
whales.
And throw and what
space whales?
Space whales. To take him and Thrawn... I was thinking of the tentacles.
I know.
To take him and Thrawn beyond the galaxy.
Oh, okay. So, alive but gone.
Yeah.
And that was presumably, like, once you're outside of Star Wars galaxy, it ain't easy to get
basically
back in.
Basically, there was no way to easily get there.
We've never they've never hinted at there is anything beyond the galaxy, so this is kind of a new wrinkle.
Right.
But that is where Thrawn and Ezra
They're in the very outer rim.
Yeah.
Well, they outright say, like, another alien, like, race came from another galaxy.
Right.
So who knows? If that felt kind of Battlestar Galactica in some aspects.
Yeah. That's probably, like, the Yuuzhan Vong, right?
It's not. They're not going to use on Vong. That is, I
is
guess,
it because that's,
one of the
is
most
that
hated
painted?
Things ever, yes.
I think it's...
Well, I was just wondering, like, is there any possibility Filoni would be like, I could make it work?
Yeah.
Maybe, but I don't think so.
Who were... So, the Fallen Order...
There's another couple alien
races.
You
know what it would be that it could be? Tardigrades.
I've seen some theories, because there are a couple different alien races, but it's beyond my Star Wars knowledge. I'm like, I don't know what these characters are. I know what a Yuuzhan Vong is. I don't really want them.
They are... Greedos.
They're like biotech people. They hate all non-biotech.
Borga. I think it could be the Xiphonians, which is from the Fallen Order video games.
Oh, yeah. We talked about that earlier off mic.
We will see.
I also love that David Tennant is back as the
droid. I don't remember that droid. It's weird.
Do you remember the young ones, the younglings who are making their own lightsabers, that arc in Clone Wars? He's big in there.
Okay. There's definitely some Clone Wars stuff where I'm, like, fuzzy on it, where I've seen,
what's
like,
the cute little animal once. That people were talking about?
Oh, that's
about.
The Lothal cats.
Yeah, Lothcats.
Lothcats. They're native to Lothal, which is the...
Are you saying they're Lolcats?
They're not Lolcats.
I will say, complete animatronics.
Oh, yeah, I heard
it
that.
Was really cool to see them do a lot of these practical effects.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
Because, like...
It makes a difference.
David Tennant is a partial practical effect. I don't think, like, his legs are. I think they had to CG that because they're very spindly.
Yeah.
But they're interacting with a lot of things. And
David Tennant himself is CG?
Did you not know that? Yeah, David Tennant is fully CG.
That would explain...
Actually, 90% of British people are
his
CG.
Charm. Yeah, so most of the charm is actually CG.
Yeah, there's actually only 100 British people. They just CG them.
I guess we'll see if there's a change in tone, because by the time we get home...
Yeah.
Tonight. It premieres at 6 tonight. Yeah. So I'm excited to watch that.
I'm excited to not be able to watch that.
I will get you a login. Stop your belly aching.
Speaking of Nick's logins, I watched... You bought Joyride.
I went and bought a ton of freaking movies.
And I watched Joyride.
Yes.
And it is a ton of fun.
Joyride was great. It was one of those where I was in kind of an R-rated comedy mood, and luckily there were a couple. This one was definitely my favorite of the ones I watched.
Now tell me, what's this Joyride all about?
I wanted to see this. Some friends watched it and said it was really good. I've heard a lot of friends saying it was really good. So basically,
it's not star Paul Walker.
It is four Asian American friends, women and non-binary, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
Basically, they go to... So, I guess I should start with... It is. There's two lead characters, really. One, they met when they were kids. Mm-hmm. One of them was adopted by this white family, and the other is a Chinese family. And these kids became friends and grew up. And the one who has the Chinese family is sort of like a... kind of a slacker artist person.
Okay.
Her family owns a restaurant. And the other one became like a very driven person. She's a lawyer.
Yeah.
And she is about to close this big deal for her company. And in order to do that, she has to go to China. And she's taking her friend along, because she doesn't speak Chinese, but her friend does.
Uh-huh.
And
slacker friend?
Yes.
Yeah. And then slacker friend's friend?
If she closes this deal, she will get the promotion she wants and all this stuff. And also, her slacker friend is like, well, while we're in China, let's go find your real mom.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, I don't want any part of that. My parents are my parents, all that kind of thing. Slacker brings along their other friend, Deadeye, who is a non-binary, just hilarious character.
Yeah, they're great.
And they're going to meet her friend's, non-Slacker friend's, college roommate, who is now a actress in a...
Kind of like a big
Chinese
deal
soap
Chinese
opera
soap
kind
opera.
Of thing.
Okay.
And she's played by Stephanie Hsu from...
Everything Everywhere All at Once.
And all various things. The four of them basically wind up in a variety of shenanigans as they're trying. She's trying to make her, you know, she's trying to make this business deal. They go to a bar where she tries to keep up with this guy drinking,
mm-hmm.
And it's very funny. It's very sweet. It is written. It's co-written by the person who wrote Crazy Rich Asians. Yep.
What's the raunchy level?
Pretty high raunchy level.
Yeah. 1 to 10.
Seven.
Like a, okay. Yeah, 7 or 8.
Someone does blow cocaine. They all have to do cocaine at one point.
Yeah, so hide cocaine up their butts.
And add cocaine up their butts.
How many lightsaber fights?
No lightsaber fights.
Okay, sorry. I mixed up what we were talking about.
There is a series of injuries caused when they meet up with a basketball team and they all have sex with various basketball players.
Yep. That was interesting.
Yep.
There's also a tattoo in a very interesting spot.
There's a tattoo in a very interesting spot. They pretend to be a K-pop group.
Yep.
It's a ton of fun. The script is excellent. There's some really funny dialogue.
But I will also say,
all the actresses are great.
There's a good lesson and like heart
I do like
to
be.
It's very sweet.
I do like to learn a lesson.
And yeah. a great appearance from Daniel Day Kim.
Yes. Yeah, Daniel Day Kim was great in it. This was one of my favorite movies I've seen this year. It was very, very funny, and I liked everybody in it. I would highly recommend it for people. Nick, you've been watching The Good Wife?
Yes. I don't know when this started up. When did it, like,
it's,
did it, was
let
it, like,
me look, let me look.
Was it 2009?
It was a ways back.
So this stars Juliana Margulies.
Mm-hmm. 2009,
okay. So, stars Juliana Margulies. It's about a woman whose husband was like
played
the,
by Chris Noth.
Chris Noth, who's
he's a bastard person.
Yeah, like a bastard person.
But he was a Democratic senator?
No, he was a prosecutor. Like the lead prosecutor for the state of, I think it's New York.
Illinois?
Or
Illinois, they're in Chicago.
Chicago, right. And he gets framed essentially for doing shitty things. I forget exactly what it is.
Wasn't he cheating on her?
Well, yes, that was an ancillary, but he also was like
manipulating
things behind the scenes.
Like he might go to jail for this stuff.
Yeah. But yes, he did cheat on her with call girls and prostitutes. And it's her sort of dealing with that while also joining a firm as a junior associate, and kind of trying to make a name for herself and earn a living. I will say that this is created by the people who do Evil. This is their first
the Kings. Yep.
This yeah, the Kings.
First things, yep.
It's not as bonk. It's not. It's no. It could not be bonkers like Evil because Evil is insane,
right?
And I love it so much. But the attention to detail, the interesting twists and turns, the characters that are super likable.
This is a legal show.
It is.
Lots of time in the courtroom.
Yes and no. It's evenly split.
It's closer to something like The West Wing, I would say, where it's about. It's about
kind of like how you get there and stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's not.
It's also they're defending like killers,
It's a lawyer show, but it is not Law and Order. It is not one of those. It is
tung tung.
Yeah, it is. It is more about the law.
Yeah, and how to work around it to save your client.
Yeah.
Because they do literally represent killers in the sense of like Dylan Baker, who is
they've got fascinating ongoing characters. Yes.
How do we sympathize with them if they're representing killers?
Because they're still good people. Somebody has to do it.
Yeah,
and they wrestle with it.
Back in the 90s, I watched who's the guy who made all those shows then, like Ally McBeal and stuff.
David Kelly.
I watched that show he did, Picket Fences.
Yeah.
The actor Fyvish Finkel played a almost born litigator.
Yeah.
And he would defend the worst of the worst people. And that was like the first time I kind of became aware of this idea of like, you know, kind of how important that is to our system. But the show was always kind of trying to challenge the viewer on it and like be like, well, you know, what can we accept? You know, what is too far and what is it, you know, like, is it still, you know, it's like, well, that's the legal right and all that, but is it right? And that show I thought did a pretty good job of standing up for that principle.
Yeah.
So it sounds like that's kind of where this
it's not one note.
Challenges you though.
It's not one note. They definitely sort of deal with like the mental ramifications of doing what you have to do in order to get your client, even though you know that this person is probably going to do something else again.
Yeah,
I think Juliana Margulies is great. I forget how good she is. I watched her on ER forever. And I think she got sort of overshadowed a lot on that.
I think that's true. This is her chance to be sort of the lead.
And she kicks ass.
Yeah.
But I will also say, this has one of the best cast lists of shows.
It really does.
Like, random people you wouldn't even... Like, Pedro Pascal. He plays one of the DAs. He looks so young. The Mandalorian himself.
Little baby Pedro.
But Mike Coulter shows up. I guess this is where...
That's where they first poached
him from.
Scoped him out, yeah.
Yeah. But there's also their lead investigator who was on Hijack recently.
Yep, Kalinda.
There's just so many good people involved. Like, all the judges are character actors that you would recognize. It's a ton of fun.
I like this way. I am not a lawyer show person.
But then
I really like The Good Wife.
Yeah, the head of the law firm that they work at is Christine Baranski and Josh Charles.
Yeah.
Who Josh Charles from Sports Night and Christine Baranski from
There's definitely
everything.
Sort of a will they, won't they between Josh Charles and Mark.
Yeah. But again, it's not a one note, like.
No, it's well done.
It's everything is well done, and I really appreciate that.
It's not one of those things like, you know, one case per season or.
No. It's definitely.
It's very episodic.
Very episodic. It is kind of got that comfort TV feel to it.
Episodic is actually one of the things I most like about Evil. It has a meta plot, of course, but many episodes stand alone, and I can be like, oh, that's the episode with the creepy. Road trip, or that's the episode where they go to the cathedral where the monks with the vow.
The roadmap for Evil is in this show because they do episodic, but there are things that pop back up
and
at kind of random spots.
That weirdness that the Kings have, that sort of quirkiness.
Yeah,
it's not.
You know what's funny?
It's not as fully in here, but it is in here.
Yeah,
that has always at least been in there a little bit because my parents in like the 90s used to watch some of those legal shows and 80s. Like L.A. Law, and then later Ally McBeal and stuff like that. And Ally McBeal, of course, was known to be a little surreal. But, like, there has always been a little, you know, like, but it's Boston Legal and stuff like that. They kind of like a little bit of absurdity. I think because sometimes that stuff does get absurd.
Yes.
Like, just real cases, crazy things come up.
The spinoff of this, that was a Paramount Plus original.
The Good Fight.
Is The Good Fight, which is basically Christine Baranski's character goes to a all-black law firm run by Delroy Lindo. And it begins on the day that Trump gets elected, and it is very much a more political show and a weirder show.
Yeah,
and I think that is where they shine. I've watched a season of The Good Wife, but I've watched all of The Good Fight.
Nick, if you're done, I'm going to just quick sneak in and decide because I just finished watching Evil season 3.
Yeah.
Or is it 4?
It might have. I think it was season 3.
It was another satisfying season, if sometimes a little frustrating because of their meta plot.
I do think a lot more gets resolved in third season.
Let me just ask you a question.
Current season?
Yes, and like so among like the big sort of stories it had, David. By the way, for people who just haven't seen this show at all, I know we've talked about it several times, but a trio of people investigate stuff for the Catholic Church.
Yep.
That's kind of what it amounts to. It's got a mixture of horror and sort of drama and bizarre. Like, you will probably at least once per episode go, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Especially when they actually got onto Paramount and were doing
it. You could actually say that, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a priest who was priest in training for a couple seasons and is now a priest. What's his name? David Coulter?
Yeah. Mike Coulter.
Mike Coulter, AKA
yeah,
Luke Cage,
yep.
Very handsome guy. And then there's a, what's her name? Kristen is, I forget the actress, but she's like a expert legal witness who does like psychological exams. I forget what her actual job is.
She's a psychologist.
Yeah. And so she's there to assess, it's like if the church is going to perform an exorcism or anything like that.
Is this person actually crazy?
Crazy or not? And then there's kind of like their techie.
Asif Mandvi.
And is maybe the most beloved, I think, character
He's
by many
great.
As Ben.
Yep.
Amazing Ben.
Amazing Ben. And... and then there's like Kristen's family and there's ongoing plots and but Leland of course is the recurring creepy threat who's seems to be a guy who works for demons.
Played by Michael Emerson.
By Michael Emerson, and if you've ever seen him in anything, you know... I know he's not always a bad guy, but, like, if you've ever seen him play a bad guy, you know how creepy
this
he
one he gets to turn it up to 15.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't... Yeah. He just, like, says, screw it, I'm not gonna, I don't even get up to 10. I'm gonna go to 15.
It would be campy if he wasn't so good at it.
Yeah,
he's fantastic. And they do embrace a little bit of over-the-top stuff frequently.
I think the third season also expands on Christine Lottie's performances. I think she's great. The mom.
Yeah, that is fascinating. She has, like, kind of a cougar mom, Kristen does, who early on I was like, oh, well, you know, she's kind of self-centered and kind of hard and cruel at times, but she loves the kid and she loves the kids and she loves Kristen. And I'm like, oh, she's dating Leland, who seems to be a guy who's, like, really a terrible person.
That character goes back and forth.
Dating Leland,
but
utilizing...
She seemed to, like, really go bad this season.
Well, utilizing some sort of, like, possessed
stuff.
Dolls.
Yeah. Well, there was also the kidnapping of Kristen's husband.
Yep.
And in this season.
Pumping his blood full of random...
Whatever they are doing, it's messed up. And I wish they would have explained that, by the way.
But also, what? Kurt Fuller gets a lot in the third season?
Who's Kurt Fuller?
Her psychologist.
Yeah. He's actually a side support character I really like, and I'm worried about him, of course, because of this thing. He in this gets persuaded by Leland, again, a man who lies down with devils,
he wants to write a book.
He wants to write a book, and he's having sort of writer's block, and Leland is like, first of all, he's like, there's a little ritual you can do that'll help kind of focus your thoughts, and it's, you know, kind of a little weird and creepy, and and some singing and stuff like that, but it's just a little kind of, it's not so bad. And he does that, and he does find inspiration from it. And then he's like, goes to like watch a... What is it, like a black mass sort of ritual sort of thing? That's like, oh, it's like somebody's going to become possessed by the devil. It's like the opposite of an exorcism. You go to have somebody be possessed, and there's like a congregation of like Satan worshippers around. And he's telling the psychiatrist, he's like, you know what would be really amazing for your book? If you let yourself be taken over. Like, what, you know, can you imagine? And so this all sort of sounds crazy, but so you know, like, if you haven't seen it before, the show walks... often a sort of a knife's edge between what is supernatural and what isn't. And very often they leave it ambiguous, but the investigations are great, super fun. Ben and Kristen, and whether they're interviewing somebody, looking in on someone possessed, sometimes it's creepy. Sometimes it's very creepy. Sometimes it's funny.
I also love the Andrea Martin's character that they added, pretty much the sister Andrea.
Yeah, Ben's sister?
Yeah. No. The nun.
Oh, yeah. She's huge this season, and that will kind of bring me to something I wanted to ask you guys. I felt this season, you know, when she goes into their house and she's like, yeah, you basically have a demon infestation, and she starts hitting him with a shovel? Most people can't see him. They just see her hitting, like, the floor.
Yeah.
But she sees, like, demon head splattering and bug-like demons
and
stuff.
It's like the house next door to Kristen's, right?
No, yes. But there's that's actually in Kristen's house. She's, like, talking to the daughter who wants to become a nun now, too.
Oh, right.
Yeah. While she's, like, smashing, the nun is actually smashing things in their kitchen. Yeah. And I'm like, now, I know that we're seeing this from the nun's perspective, and you could say she's an unreliable narrator and she's seeing what she wants to see, but to me, the show this season has stopped worrying completely about every... Like, there's standalone episodes where you're like, is this real? Is this supernatural? But I'm like, do y'all take it as a given that those are demons are real?
Yes.
Because I do at this point.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think... We're not in X-Files. That's one of the things I really like about Evil. They haven't gone to X-Files territory where you're like...
don't be stupid.
I don't know if she'll ever believe in aliens. Like, they all have and can see.
Once you've been kidnapped by aliens.
Even Ben has seen enough to be like, okay, yeah, some of this is real.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, like, he joined... Like, he had his venture with the cult, like, out in, like, the country.
Yeah.
But they all have dealt with some sort of supernatural aspect, even though they're now telling themselves that that can't have been real or something like that. There is enough here that, like,
and we've seen from
Ben from Lost, Michael Emerson's point of view.
Yeah,
I mean, he literally talks with a giant frickin' demon,
right? And the boss at their company, where I always one of the cool things about the show is that it's always hip deep in modern technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so Christian's cougar mom is like running like a troll farm, and they she's like promoting like NFTs and cryptocurrency and stuff like that. But that like the cryptocurrency was called like macabre and stuff like that. Always sort of with a little bit of a demonic thing. My favorite episode of the season was the one that had their TikTok analog, where everybody gets onto TikTok.
Yes. Yeah.
And they see how the algorithm sort of directs them. So, like, at first, like, priest David is, like, getting sort of helpful advice from other priests, being very candid. But then they kind of start talking about, like, what priests who are having temptations and things like that. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I didn't choose any of those videos, but the algorithm pushed me towards it. And every one of them, like, kind of finds themselves clinging to their phone and checking, you know, their TikToks regularly. And it is not some overt, like, TikTok's bad, but it does kind of like try, it definitely has an awareness of someone is trying to profit off of most everything we do like that.
Yeah.
And in this case of the show, sometimes it's fun demonic stuff.
Sometimes it's demons. It's
but it is like a incredibly high fun factor show.
Yes.
Every episode has funny stuff in it, creepy stuff in it, and several WTF moments.
Yep.
All right. I think that will wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo show.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.